Welcome to the Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade, and on behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer. Before we get started with today's show, I have a quick word. Charlotte Readers Podcast now has podcast books. It's true, we have two kinds, fiction and nonfiction. Our fiction book is titled Death by Podcasting, co-written by Landis and me. It's a comedic mystery where we make fun of podcasters and writers in the vein of Only Murders in the Building. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. We also have 8 nonfiction quote books created from over 500 podcast interviews. The Write Quote series is a collection of inspirational and practical quotes about writing, publishing, and book marketing from the first 4 years of the podcast. The books come with forewords and reflections by Hannah, Landis, and me. They're available in paperback and ebook, and here's a bonus. The first ebook in the series, about the writing life, can be downloaded for free. You can find links for all 9 books at the podcast books page of charlottereaderspodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and if you read our books, thanks for reading. Now let's get on with the show.
In this episode 387, we feature Dana Trent and her memoir, Between Two Trailers, a powerful story about a girl who escapes her childhood as a preschool drug dealer in rural Indiana to become a graduate of Duke Divinity School. Publishers Weekly calls the memoir a blend of grit and hope. Other reviews invoke the phrases luscious prose, ludicrously good plot, unflinching truth, full of resilience and redemption, and a memoir in the vein of great literary coming-of-age narratives. This book is a fast, surprising, shocking, and inspiring read. Dana, welcome to the show.
Oh, Landis, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, congratulations on the publication of Between Two Trailers. I was fascinated by the book. I really enjoyed it, and hats off to you for the courage to write it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was quite a slog. The path to get here has been long and circuitous, but absolutely worth it.
Yeah. And thanks to our mutual friend, John, who tipped me off to this story and connected us. If you're listening, John, there you go. Hey, listen, I want to start with the present day, because the Dana Trent that people meet and interact with today came a long way from your origin story, and they're probably going to be shocked when they pick up and read this book and learn about your past, what's revealed in this memoir. So let's start with today. Tell us about Dana Trent of the day, a little bit about your vocation, your education, training, your standard of living, what a typical day looks like.
I'm a writer and professor based in Raleigh, North Carolina. I teach in the North Carolina Community College system for Wake Tech Community College, where I teach critical thinking and world religions. And so my day is comprised of a little bit of writing in the morning, teaching adolescents how to problem solve and embrace other cultures and religion and spiritual traditions. And then also just hanging out with my husband. We've got 2 cats and we love to garden and we're vegetarians. And so watching a little Duke basketball, if things are going well with our men's basketball team, but that's really a day in the life of my life now, certainly different from how it started 43 years ago.
Yeah. And we can see each other as we're recording this, though it's audio for our listeners. It doesn't look like you're in a trailer.
No, I'm not in a trailer. No, and Landis, it's interesting you say that because I'm living in a house, like an actual single family dwelling, for the first time in my life. That was a huge change for me, and that just happened recently. And so things have come a long way, but I'm constantly mindful of where I came from because that Dana, that budgie Dana, lives inside of me, and she and I have to integrate and talk to each other every day. You know, to pinch myself to realize that this is my life now, but also to remember that it wasn't always the case.
Yeah, so let's travel back in time for a moment. We're going to talk about the setting, your hometown, in a few minutes. But for now, I just want to do a little compare and contrast here, what you just told us about yourself with some of the things that you experienced as a child, the kind of experiences that were opposite of, what you have today, food, shelter, the drug dealing part of it. Just give us a few highlights. We're going to do a little compare and contrast here.
So I grew up in a trailer in rural Western Indiana, a place where that is known for its being a food desert and food insecurity. My parents were educated, but unwell. My father was a recreational therapist and my mother was a psychiatric nurse. But when I was born and raised in Indiana, they were not working. And so their mental health had impeded them from functioning in professional settings. And so the trailer was often just the three of us. We were isolated. We had family there, but our family wasn't aware of how we were making ends meet. And the way we were making ends meet was trafficking drugs. And so I became a part of that from an early age. And one of the most interesting things about the drug trafficking business is that my father ran it as though it were also a religion. And so later, fast forwarding, we're going to get to this, but when I graduated from Duke Divinity School, I realized that the way he structured his beliefs and values and his professional life, both in recreational therapy and in drug trafficking, had an ethos of religion and spirituality infused. And so I was born with that, and we ran the business as such. There were rules and regulations, there were liturgies, there were blessings, there was community. And so even though it was a really hard time growing up in that trailer, I always had access to faith, which kept me going. And also my parents raised me in a fervent belief that, you know, God was always present for us, even in the hard times.
Well, you know, you really have to read this book to sort of get a sense of what it was like in that trailer. But you described the shortage of food. You would sometimes be eating ketchup sandwiches. Your father, who you've described, is going through some mental, I mean, he has a trap door. He strips the, tell us about stripping the mattress and why he does that. Yeah.
So my father's schizophrenia manifested in sort of these daily federal wiretap searches. And when you're unwell and your brain is very busy, and we could always tell how busy my father's brain was by what was happening on the outside. His mental illness was very explicit. And so he would cut a hole in our kitchen and make it a trap door so that he could move in and out of the trailer's outside wall metal skirting. And he covered it with a recliner that even the rats had abandoned. And so you can tell by just that, even stripping mattresses, razoring ceilings, you know, he was never without his razor blade. And it was just a constant voice in his head that told him that someone was watching and someone was after him. And when you live like that, most of us can't understand what it's like to have that sort of brain. But I liken it to, you know, being very nearsighted or farsighted and not having glasses, right? And so everything you see is distorted and you can't understand why other people aren't seeing the way that you are viewing the world. And so for him, the world was a dangerous place. And so all of my training was focused on that. You know, soldier, everyone is your enemy. Therefore, you must be prepared and you must also keep your knife and your razor blade handy to cut out holes in the floor.
Yeah. And he sort of taught you and trained you up, right? Mm-hmm. To be tough with, to protect yourself and that kind of thing.
Exactly. He gave me a knife when I was a preschooler and trained me how to use it. And he gave me a street name, and the street name is Budgie, which is a little parakeet that is excellent at repeating back syntax to their owner. And so the idea was I was his lookalike. I was his twin, and I was also his lookout in the business.
Wow. So I know you had a complicated relationship with your parents. You talk about that in the book. And many people might wonder how you could continue to maintain a relationship with them given some of the childhood experiences you were exposed to. But having said that, and despite all that, were there things that your parents instilled in you or things about yourself that are uniquely them that you continue to carry with you today?
Yes. Going back to mental illness, my father and mother both believed that many folks who had mental illness and or are impoverished ate ketchup sandwiches or, you know, were forced to live in food deserts. They believed that the only difference between us and them is who's got the keys. And what they meant by that motto is that everyone is struggling, right? But there are always folks in power. And folks in power are often the ones who hold the resources, aka the keys. And so they taught me from a young age to be sensitive and empathetic to all those who are subjugated and oppressed and those who don't have the keys. And so by virtue of their professional training in the psych systems and also who they were as people, my father is schizophrenic and my mother had borderline personality disorder and dependent personality disorder. The idea was that folks are struggling. And Dana, as soon as you can learn to anticipate needs and take care of folks, you will live a fuller life. This was their motto, because you will be a good listener and you will learn to ask the why questions of why are folks in the position they're in? Why are they doing what they're doing? And you'll learn to be curious about people so that you can help them. And they instilled that from a very early age. And I was their helper. Both in my mother's sense and in my father's sense of what they each needed.
Hmm. All right, well, let's focus on the town a little bit that you spent the first 6 years of your life in and that you visited in the summers, because you did have other family there that you would go back to and visit. It's called Dana, Indiana, and it's the town for whom you're named. You do a wonderful job describing the small town in your book. Your late father, who called himself the king, or everybody else called him the king, mm-hmm. calls it the best place to commit a murder. Wow. And while life was plenty tough there for you, you talk about midnight bike rides and other fun activities. So how would you describe Dana, Indiana then and now to someone who knows very little about the place?
It's a hidden corner of rural America. And, you know, especially in an election year, I feel like we need to all be curious about these hidden corners. And Dana is the birthplace to Ernie Pyle, who is one of the first World War II correspondents who spoke directly to the American people about everyday soldiers' experiences. And that ethos lives on in Dana, Indiana. Ernie is our hometown hero. And it's also this idea that folks speak plainly in Dana. The truth is not withheld. And our father, my father, never withheld the gospel of business or the gospel of poverty from us. And he taught us that, I say us, my cousins and me, through these midnight bike rides, which were these tours of Dana in which he recounted the fist fights of his youth or when he set cop cars on fire, you know, all these sordid tales. But they were really tales of survival, because this was a different time and things were very tough in these, and rural poverty is tough. And today, you know, there is a lot of food insecurity in Dana, still a lot of hurt. And it becomes, you know, it's still one of the places in which I feel is a forgotten part of America. It's what we call flyover country. And that was the main reason for writing this book, is that this book is a love letter to the hidden corners of America, where life is hard. And sometimes folks don't understand the intricacies of how difficult it is to live in a place that where you feel like you're forgotten.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It kind of leads into my next question, because I was going to comment that there's really too much to cover in a 30-minute podcast about your life story. And in fact, you have a podcast of your own called Breaking Good. I love the playoff of Breaking Bad. It goes into some details of your story. You know, I'm just wondering, first of all, beyond this love letter to rural America, why you decided to write this book, and also really about the timing of the book, because you wrote four other books first, including one about your marriage between you, a Christian minister, and your husband, a Hindu monk, and some other books. And this is the fifth book, and not, you'd think, well, you know, if you're going to write a book and all you've been through, this would be the first book. So why is it the fifth book, and what propelled this book into our hands?
I was not ready to confront my past. I was not ready to make peace with the people and places that have shaped me. I was not ready to understand that despite all of my parents' shortcomings and their, you know, what we might call demons, that there was value in growing up like this. And there is value in integrating these two very disparate parts of myself. You know, earlier you mentioned my education and where I am now. I don't live in a trailer. I'm a graduate from Duke Divinity School. You were a trial lawyer and went to Wake Forest Law School. I mean, it's interesting that we have this dichotomy, right, of who we are now and our professional sort of put together lives, but then how we got to this space. And I was not ready to explore that journey until, first of all, my parents passed away, because we all have a different relationship with our parents in death than in life. And then I think when I hit my 40s and we were in the pandemic, it occurred to me that if I were going to do my own trauma healing, I needed to go home, because home is where the war is, but it's also where the healing begins.
So you said you're not ready to make peace. How did you make peace?
I make peace through writing, you know, and I'm sure your readers and you as a writer, Landis, I mean, I don't know if you feel this way, but I write to figure things out. But when I'm confronted with a difficult story, sometimes that is the one that is the hardest to write about, because it's full of anger and rage and pain and sadness and grief. And so for me, I needed to write those first four books on spirituality and coping and put tools in my toolbox so that I was ready to write this fifth book. And as a writer, like, is that one of the ways too that you, do you tend to process the world around you through your books and through prose?
Yeah. And I've interviewed a lot of writers on the podcast who speak to that very idea that they use writing sort of to figure things out, not necessarily to explain things.
Right. That's right.
That, in the process, things can explain themselves to you just by sitting down and, getting after it. Your website calls you an author, professor, and preschool drug dealer. I love the marketing side of that.
There's the integration, right?
Yeah. Author, professor, preschool drug dealer. Say what? You know?
Like, right.
And clearly on your website, you're not hiding your past. You're telling the world that your father, the king, and your mother, who in the book is referred to as the lady, used you as a preschooler to help run a low-level drug business in the Midwest. And you were the lookout, as you said, and you made drops. And you sat at the counter of a broken-down trailer where you lived and used a razor to separate seeds. And, you know, you've talked about the food. But in the book, you have these acknowledgments about how important it was to have these extended family members care for you as well. And when you look back on that phase of your life, you know, how do you, and you probably tried to process this as you wrote, but how do you see yourself then as an adult versus how you saw yourself then as a young preschooler?
When you're living a traumatic childhood, like the one you just described, you're in survival mode. Your body and brain is in survival mode. And so that higher level thinking, that executive functioning that you as a lawyer and really good critical thinkers have, that problem solving function, the ability to look at the world and gather evidence and make sense of it is non-existent, right? Because your body is saying we need to fight, we need to flee, we need to fawn, or we need to freeze. It's very basic. And so that's sort of that part of me. And then when you get to a place, going full circle to where we started, where you have a home, you've got food in your belly, you've got a job, then you can begin to do some of that telos work, that meaning-making work to understand those two very disparate parts of you. And that's when you start seeing the angels that were surrounding you and getting you through those tougher times of basic survival mode. And I think for me and for other readers and writers, folks who are listening to this podcast, it's about how do we grapple with where we came from and who our family is while searching for who we are meant to become, right? And who we are now. And that's the journey. And you don't have to be a preschool drug dealer to appreciate that journey. And most of us have these disparate parts of ourselves. And so the message for readers is you can go home, whether it's literal or metaphorical, but you also have to be willing to do the work of scratching the surface and beginning to grapple with the parts of ourselves that need integration.
It sounds a little bit like you're grateful for some of the experiences that you had.
Yes. And I don't say that to minimize the experiences. I don't say that to minimize the experiences of little kiddos who are going through this right now, because there are so many. But I say that to say, if we survive our ACEs, our adverse childhood trauma, And if we can function as adults, then it is our duty and our responsibility to look around us and to be active and serve in the community in order to help others do the same. Mm.
So in your acknowledgments, the first two lines are for Achilles, Luz, Marietta, Linda, and Doggy, I would not have survived without you. Could you tell us about that?
Oh my gosh, they are my angels. These are all characters in the book, my brother, my aunt, my uncle, and my two first cousins. And I would not have survived without them. They fed me, they sheltered me, they clothed me, they made sure I always had, access to books and computers so I could learn and be successful in school. They loved me, they supported me through my ups and downs, which are many. Because the wounds of childhood are deep and it takes a long time to figure out just how to be in relationship with people. And so this is the core group. This is the core community that got me through. And I would not have survived without them. When you write a book and you look at the path and you look and you start to shake the mental and physical Polaroids, you begin to see who's actually in the picture. Mm-hmm. And who had your back from the beginning. And it's dedicated to them because they were it from the beginning.
When was the last time you went back?
The last time I went home was last February. Is that right? Yes. Last February, I attended and spoke at a eulogy for a friend's service, a dear friend's service. And so I will actually be home, though, for a book tour. And so we're launching, launch this book, and I'm headed home actually as soon as possible. We've got three stops in Indiana, and it will be so good to be home and to share this story because it is my gift. It is my love letter to Indiana.
It's interesting you refer to it as home. Mm-hmm. It had that long-lasting relationship of home because you went back in the summers. But actually, when you were about 7 or 8 years old, your mother essentially kidnapped you and brought you to North Carolina, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And you lived in the Chapel Hill area, and then you went back to her hometown, and you grew up and went to middle school and college and so forth. But you still think of this as home.
I do. And Landis, you understand this as a Southerner. It's the South and the Midwest are very different. And we learn about regionalism, through amazing authors like Flannery O'Connor. We learn about the Christ-haunted South and the grotesque parts of the South. But these are two very different regions, as you know, right? As someone who lives in North Carolina, who grew up here. And so that was a total shift. It's like tire screeching. And you go from the gritty rural Midwest home to North Carolina, which is genteel and Southern and polite. And folks are accommodating, but they also have expectations of how you should behave. And so for me, I think I'm beginning to call Indiana home because it was expunged from my record for decades. And you understand that. Mm-hmm. It's like, we're going to wipe you clean of Indiana and you are only to claim your North Carolina heritage. And so now I'm beginning to balance it back out and reach back for home in the Midwest.
For all things Charlotte Readers Podcast, check out charlottereaderspodcast.com. You can find a list of all episodes, an alphabetical guest list with links, detailed show notes for each episode, a community blog, and more. We'd love to have you visit.
All right, well, I'm going to have some more questions here, but I'd love to have you read a little section from the book,
sure,
if you would.
Yes. This section is called Story Shrapnel. It's actually my favorite because it speaks to what you and I were just talking about with Ernie Pyle and with the Midwest and how Midwestern stories are put together. Okay? This is Story Shrapnel. Hoosiers are not Texans. Our stories don't unfurl in molasses-thick accents and Dallas tough guy tapestries. Indiana is the land of Stranger Things and methamphetamine, not Mary Carr and moonshine jars. A solid Corn Belt story is as dusty as a grain elevator at harvest. We refuse tidy narratives because archives are for rich people, which we are not. We are raccoons, not raconteurs, spewing scraps of Americana alongside rusted trash barrels. Our listeners urgently piece together whose son stabbed whose brother at whose dining room table, because the culprit may be staring right at you. He may even be your own kin. From gossip to family lore, The oral history of my hometown and namesake, Dana, Indiana, is told in story shrapnel. It's scattered in burnt minefields of timelines and spent bullets where wounded characters who echo across Vermilion County live. Ask too much, you'll get a war. Ask nothing, you'll get more. Indiana's landlocked erraticism creates the kind of culture that births steel courage like Ernie Pyle's. A Pulitzer Prize-winning Hoosier and patron saint of frontline war stories, Ernie came from this lush land of cornfields that offers America food it loves and people it loves to disdain. A battlefield is, after all, a place. It's dirt and people and weapons and stories. It's wounds and rage. These pages are filled with the casings of blown up lives. Herein is a true story, one that is at its best when uncovering healing in the very places where violence thrives. This is a book for anyone who thinks they can't go home.
That's beautiful. And I would say in the advance reader copy that I got for the book, there's a little letter here in here from the publisher. She says, in my 30 years of publishing, rarely have I seen a proposal as promising as Between Two Trailers by Dana Trent. Out of the dozens of memoir proposals we read each year, Dana's work instantly stood out to our entire team for its exceptional writing, compelling storytelling, and riveting family history. And her voice in this gripping account is fresh, powerful, and so poignant, it instantly evokes the masterful writing in memoirs like Heartland by Sarah Smarsh and Made by Stephanie Land and Educated by Tara Westover. Dana might be new on the scene, but her voice and her story will stay with you for a long time. And I hear the voice in your writing, Dana, and I hear the voice as you're speaking here. And I'm just wondering, your father, he had a big voice, a booming voice, and he had these, what you call visions. How do you say it? Visions?
Visions.
He had these visions. Yeah.
Yes.
And one of his vision was that you weren't going to be no beat down dog. I guess he meant by that, that no one's going to take advantage of you. You're going to survive. You're going to make it. You're going to do well. And I guess his vision turned out to be accurate after all, right?
Oh, he would love to hear you say that, Landis. You're right. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Right. Thanks be to King.
Exactly. And let's talk about in your publicity materials a minute. In the book, there's a theme, and you talked a little bit about it a second ago, that you can't really make it until you return to where your story began, home. And, you know, it's funny when I read that and I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about the Wizard of Oz and how this is not the Wizard of Oz.
Right.
This is not Dorothy clicking her ruby slippers and going home to this wonderful environment that she had before she was faced with all these difficulties in the Land of Oz. No, you're talking about going home to a place that was very difficult to begin with. So tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that, that you really can't make it until you return to that home. Mm.
You know, I think those of us who go away to school, whether it's, you know, Wake Forest Law School or whether it's Duke University, Davidson, wherever it is, right? There's this idea that when we go to school and we learn things and we get jobs and we make it, right, that we no longer need to confront those past hurts. We no longer need to go back and look at where we grew up. And maybe we no longer need to stay connected with parts of our family with whom we disagree with, right? But I think in today's American culture and society, it is more important than ever to have a willingness and a curiosity to go home, whether it's literal or metaphorical. And what I mean by that is that we are all existing more than ever in our silos of ideas and evidence and critical thinking silos. And so we tend to put up these walls when in reality, proximity reduces prejudice. So when we are willing to put our walls down, whether it's within our own family, our own experiences, our childhood experiences, we can glean data. I mean, there's data in that about who we are and who are we are meant to become. But I think so many of us cut off parts of our family or parts of our lives in the name of surviving and resilience. And we think that we have escaped and made it, when in reality, we cannot be who we are meant to become until we integrate even the most disparate parts of our lives. And I think anyone who's listening that is a child of divorce, or anyone who's listening who has one side of the family that is favored over the other, you know, all of us have this at some micro or macro level. And so for me, it means returning to our roots, returning to our communities, returning to the disconnected parts of ourselves in order to learn more about who we are and to also become our full selves.
Yeah. And this, this story that you, that you're sharing with the world now, it wasn't as simple as, okay, once I get out of Indiana, things are going to, you know, work out great for me. Your mother, pretty much in the first part of this story, is laying around in a trailer while you and your father are dealing drugs. But then she pulls you out from Indiana, pulls you away from all your friends and family there, takes you to North Carolina. There's bankruptcy involved. She ends up back home. You're kind of taking care of her, you know, as you're trying to figure the world out yourself. And it's not a big part of the book, but you do talk about your struggles in college, about how you, you know, you kind of went off the rail doing certain things, and you also were kind of isolated at times, and people made fun of you because you would go home and look after your mother, which was an odd thing too. So the struggle actually continued for you well beyond leaving Indiana, correct?
Oh, yeah, the struggle continues now. Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad you brought that up, because, you know, we have this tendency to see someone who is holding down a job or who did graduate from a good school and say, oh, they've got their lives together, right? But what we don't see is all the failures, all the mistakes, all the trial and error, right? All the deficits, all the things, all the hangups, the addictions, the ways in which we just were maladaptive coping, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's actually one of my favorite parts of the book. And we could have written 5 books about that part alone, is because you do get to see the failure, which I think for me as a reader and a writer, I don't know about you, Landis, but to me, that's why I read books. You know, that connection point that you have with the author, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I want to see how they are messing up, whether it's in their characters are messing up or they're messing up, so that, and what they've learned, so that I can learn from it myself. And yeah, that's sort of the most important part that I think often gets glossed over, is what mistakes and what failures did we have?
Yeah. And you mentioned, these, land masses colliding. And by that, I mean, the Midwest and the South, you know, this intersection of your life between rural Indiana, living in that county, that's the best place to kill someone, and living in the South where it's debutante time.
Yes.
You know, in the Piedmont of North Carolina, where expectations are to be a good Southern girl who attends a Baptist church several times a week. So I'm trying to figure out what stuck with you the most. Are you a blend? Are you a combination of all of this? Is it all in your inside of you?
It's all inside of me. It is. And, you know, some days I'm Budgie and some days I'm Revy. Revy is what my mother called me. And so, and it swings back and forth, right? Not in a strange way, but in a sense that they both live inside of me, and the way they raised me lives inside of me. And that was the gift of their mental illness, of their mania, their depression, their schizophrenia, their psychosis, is that I did, because of their life decisions, live in these two very different places and learn from two very different parents who were insistent that I be their daughter. So my father wanted his gritty Budgie and my mother wanted her polite Southern Revy. And they're gifts, right, to be in being exposed to those two worlds. I don't know anything about your parents or your relationship with them, but I think we all sort of, you know, imbue parts of our parents, right? And we sort of notice it as we get older. Are you noticing things about yourself that you think, oh my gosh, my mother or my father would have done that, or they taught me that, instilled in you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to confess some things if I started talking that way. There's one thing that was fun to me. As a child, your mother had you watching TV evangelist Tammy Faye on repeat in the rundown Indiana trailer. And later in life, I don't know, for those of you who are listening, you may not know the whole Jim and Tammy story. It was back in the 80s, but it was a fall from grace. They built a big empire, PTL, and they were one of the early evangelists who were, you know, taking money from people that didn't need to be parting with their money and then misspending it. But anyway, so you're watching this on TV, and then later in life, you become an ordained minister. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
The irony is not lost on me. And my parents were also fervent devotees of Dr. Robert Schuller. And so when I was born, they had moved to LA to sit at his feet until they went broke. And so again, this was infused from the beginning, this idea of religion and spirituality. And I became a minister, quite frankly, because my mother wanted me to. But she also saw gifts in me that I didn't see in myself. I wanted to be a lawyer, and she was adamant that you're that's not your personality type. You're not a lawyer. You're not suited for that, she would say in her Southern drawl. You're not suited for that. And so, I landed at Duke Divinity School, and it wasn't my choice. It wasn't anything that I really saw for myself, but it was angels around me who saw those gifts. And the best gift about becoming an ordained minister is the opportunity and the honor to sit with people in the joyous parts of their lives and the hardest parts of their lives, whether they are getting married and having babies, whether it's baptism or whether their loved one is dying or they've had a divorce or they've had a trauma. And I will tell you that, you know, the 4 decades of training that my parents gave me with the ability to sit and be present in chaos, absolute chaos, that's ministry. You know, that's the thesis statement of ministry right there. So,
A couple of writing life questions. How did you or your publisher decide on the title? And what does the title mean to you, Between Two Trailers?
Great question. Linda actually gets all the credit for that title. My cousin Linda, and she came up with it when she and I were walking a track on top of a cruise ship. And I was telling her about the sordid details of spending the night at the Naughty Renaughty and these first 6 years of life. And she was a little bit shocked because it was the first time I had started to talk to her about the drug trafficking business. My other, you know, the folks that the books are dedicated to had no idea about this business. And so she said, when was all of this happening? Oh, it must have happened between two trailers. And so that was her way of marking this period of my life, right, that doesn't match any of the other periods of my life. And so Linda named it Between Two Trailers, and the publisher loved it, and we went with it.
That's great. Because rarely does the author get input on the title if you're doing it with a big publisher like you are. So when you're writing memoir, I had a memoirist, local memoirist, Judy Goldman. She's a great writer and well-known in the community, who talked about the fact that, one of the important things to do in memoir is to tell the truth and be twice as honest about yourself as you are about anybody else that appears in the book. But that can be hard, right, to reveal these things. And I'm just wondering, were there things in this book that you were reluctant to include, that you thought about taking out, but that finally you decided to leave in, and why?
It was the part that you referenced a few minutes ago, Salem College, really struggling, taking care of my mom, going home on the weekends, binge drinking, a love addiction, food addiction, you know, any kind of addiction is really hard to talk about, right? Because there's a stigma and there's a judgment associated with addiction. But I think for those of us who are traumatized in childhood, that is an outcome. You know, the data shows that we are more prone to addictive behaviors and addiction long term. And so when we can name that, right, and drop a pin in it, and I can force myself to be brave and talk about it, right, because I don't like talking about it in writing or otherwise, then we show and we open the door to conversations to show the correlation between trauma and addiction. And I think that's an important American society question and conversation that we are not having. And so for me, that was important to open the door to have conversations like what we are talking about right now, folks may say, oh, I didn't know. I had a traumatic childhood experience. I have ACEs. I didn't know that my outcomes make me prone to this chronic disease or this addiction. And so I think when we highlight the experiences in writing or in conversations, then we are making connections for folks that there are these correlations. And therefore, how can we give people more resources to talk about their own journeys, especially when it comes to addiction?
Now, we're recording this in advance, but this episode will come out probably when the book is coming out or has just come out. And I'm wondering, if you're having any nerves, butterflies at all about this story becoming more widely seen. Your friends for the first time are going to just dive into your head to talk about that.
All the things, Landis. You just named it for me. You named exactly what's going on in my brain. Yes. Yeah. And as a writer, maybe I haven't written any fiction, and so I'm fascinated by your fiction writing. But it's like we're showing the soft underbelly always, mm-hmm. even in our fiction, I would imagine, right? There's spark because mm-hmm. it's from lived experience, some of it. And so I'm absolutely scared to death, and I'm totally willing to admit that. And I know that I've got the angels and I've got King and the Lady who, even though my mother would be shocked by, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're telling our family business. I know she'd also be proud and grateful that the story is getting out there because, she would love that folks are hearing her story, right? But right. B, she would also love that we're hopefully, being helpful to readers, and King would just love it all the time, every day, because it's entertaining and it shows his stories too. But one of the ways that I'm coping with that to bring it back down to like seriousness is continuing to do talk therapy, continuing to journal, spiritual practice. I've got an amazing partner in my husband, Fred, who, soothes me and helps me relax when I'm in that up down of tears and fear and all of that. But I think it's important to show that part too, because mm-hmm. again, like this is real and this is vulnerability. And I am convinced that vulnerability is all of our superpower.
Do you have, I know it was hard for you probably at times to write and put on paper what you've put down here. Any advice for others who have a difficult story to tell about whether to write it, how to write it, how to go about it?
Start with index cards. It's so basic, right? But it's so, for me, that's where it begins. And Landis, I'd love to hear like where you like to start when you're wrestling a hard story to the ground. But for me, it was like you have a memory or you have a flash of something and write it down on an index card, put it in a box, don't worry about it. And then when you've got, a stack of index cards, then you can kind of begin to see the threads and the themes and see how things fit together. And then this was my process. That's after I had that box full of index cards, then I started corroborating. Then I put on my lawyer hat, Landis. You'd be so proud of me. Mm-hmm. And I got the court records and the military records and the medical records and letters and photographs and interviews. And then you start shaking Polaroids and in order to discern, is this real? Because when I had the first flash of memory of drug trafficking and being a lookout, I had to question myself, is this real? And I thought, I don't know if it's real. Let me put it on an index card and I'll figure it out later. And so that was my process, index cards and then corroborating everything with evidence. How do you like to start a project?
Yeah.
Do you have a specific tool?
Yeah. Come up with an idea. I'm experimenting more with Scrivener, has a good, corkboard format inside of it where you can dump research in and dump ideas in, and you kind of go back at it and just kind of spin those ideas out. That's what I'm doing now as I'm thinking about the next novel. I don't think there's a linear process to it, even though I'm a linear thinker. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes you just have to put some ideas down and kind of, let it percolate, take a walk, go work out, do something.
Yeah.
And then the ideas will come to you. I'd be interested in knowing what you hope people will take from this book, because I think there's a lot here to be learned. Not many people live the life that you lived, and yet there are a lot of life lessons here. I'm just curious what you hope people can take away from your story.
I want people to be entertained, informed, and curious. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by curious is that curious about their own family dynamics, curious about what they need to confront from their past. You know, what do they need to make peace with when it comes to their family, the people and places that have shaped them? And so, yes, I hope that's my hope, all three of those, entertained, informed, and curious.
All right. So as we wrap up here, you know, if you were, if you'd been working on this book all alone and hadn't really been, you know, telling your parents what you were doing, and but let's say they're still around and you're going to publish this book and you're going to tell them what you've done, what would you tell them right now? How would you invite them to your opening book signing?
Oh, gracious. That would be so hard. That would be really hard. I would tell them that, you know, I'm sharing your story. I'm telling your life story. I'm telling mine too, but I'm starting with you because you all had so much hurt and pain, but you survived it and you taught me how to survive it too. So thank you.
That's great. Well, it's a very inspirational story. I'm glad you've, I'm glad you can go home, but I'm glad you can be in the home that you've made now as well from this book. Listeners, you've got to go out and pick up this book, Between Two Trailers. You may not normally read memoir, but you're going to love it. If you read memoir, this is going to be one of your favorites. I guarantee it's one of mine. And Dana, hey, just want to thank you for appearing on the podcast and look forward to you taking this message out into the world and sharing it with people. Let's hope this hits a big bestseller list or something.
Oh, I love it. Thanks so much, Landis, for having me. It's been an honor to talk about the book. Thank you so much.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, write on, and rock on.